All right. Welcome, Zero Books viewers and readers and listeners. This is Pop the Left with Derek Varn and, of course, me, Douglas Lane. We're going to start out this episode by asking the question that Mark Owen asked us in the chat before we even began, which is, did real people usher in the Reagan Revolution? And by that, it doesn't just mean anybody who's real, but specifically the television program Real People. And I should say, before you got on the stream, Derek, I was watching Blogging Heads. I think it's a show called the DMZ. And those two guys were talking about whether or not Alex P. Keaton from Family Ties would have voted for Trump or not. So I feel like we're continuing the tradition of talking about outdated media. Can you keep up on Gen X crap television? Are we going to be able to have that rapport, or is it generational divide?
There is. I barely remember Real People. I actually know more about the other show you were talking about.
Family Ties. Yeah, I barely remember Real People myself, but it was an early reality TV program. They would go out and interview strange or unusual people. The only one I remember ever seeing was a guy who claimed that he could read minds, that he was telepathic, and they went and interviewed him in his home, and the host or the interviewer, the reporter asked him, can you read my mind right now? And he said, yeah, sure. So will you? And he says, no, I don't really feel like it right now. I'm not in the mood to read minds right at the moment, but maybe later. Anyhow, the point is that, yes, Real People, I think, came on the air in the late 70s. So right around the time of the Reagan Revolution. And I selected that image because I was looking around for something that would sum up the complacency and the kind of consumer culture that I think might have taken hold of the U.S. population after the Second World War. What I found was the cast of Real People, one way or another. So anyway, enough babbling for me. Welcome, Derek. What are we going to talk about today?
Today we're going to talk about a couple of things, which is the second section of Lash's Agony of the American Left. We're going to talk about an essay that we've actually briefly mentioned before, but we're going to go into more detail today about Is Revolution Obsolete, from the collection of essays by Christopher Lash, World of Nations. And we're going to talk about various answers to that impasse proposed by Lash himself, and then maybe the new left, and then maybe what we see right now. And okay. We also might talk about the categorizations of revolutions and if they mean anything.
Right. So, okay, start me out here. Do you want to start with the agony of the left, or do you want to start with Is Revolution Obsolete? I figured since we advertised on the thumbnail and the title,
let's start with Revolution's Obsolete, yeah, because it's going to tie into some of the stuff in the agony of the left.
Okay,
because they're about the same time period.
Right. So, in Is Revolution Obsolete, it was a remarkable essay for me to read from Lash, because I feel like it's one of the few essays that I've read where he really comes across like a socialist, like an insider to the question of socialist struggle. It's like the kind of thing you might hear if you went to some sectarian meeting.
Yeah. It's when the cards are actually on the table and he's not just writing as like
generic
a historiographer, or a generic social critic. A cultural social historian.
Yeah.
That's where the cards are off the table. He goes through what was then, I think, a standard. I've tried to find the text that actually that he focuses the most on, which is a write-up of the wave of liberation revolutions in the 50s and 60s, which Lash responds to kind of with he doesn't use the term bourgeois revolution, and he doesn't use the term national liberation revolution, and he doesn't use the terms that I'm going to bring in from world systems theory. But all of that's implied. He basically goes, well, why has there never been a workers' revolution where everyone said it was supposed to be? And he is writing this partially, as, you know, this is something I happen to know from doing background research, in response to the Frankfurt School idea that it was just sort of like workers' inner authoritarianism, you know, as they have been succumbed by the culture industry. Mm-hmm. That he's actually saying, no, that's not it. But also, you're going to have a hard time finding the exact, you know, corollary in these revolutions for national liberation in the developing world, because they're not the same thing. And then he goes on and says, you know, one of the most, I think, challenging things for people to read about now is when he says, look, the atom bomb really does change the calculations about the state. No one seemed to have thought that the bourgeois state could ever be this centralized without also assuming control of all the mechanisms of production. Like, mm-hmm. World War II really does change the game for Marx's theory in some way, but he, you know, he doesn't really paint out exactly how.
Yeah, where did he say that bit about the nuclear weapons? I probably didn't quite get to that bit. I was so struck by the beginning of the essay, or the first half. But I wrote down some notes on the first half, but where does he say that here? Let me see if I can find it. Because that's actually really interesting in and of itself.
Well, he doesn't actually say exactly that, except that this comes right before when he talks about George Kennan and like Realpolitik in the Cold War, in the collection World of Nations. Mm-hmm. He's, one of the things is revolutions are directed against powerful things that have arisen on the ruins of seigneurialism, but have not yet perfected the methods of repression and control available to the formal industrial state. Like, and he goes on, the foregoing considerations help explain why there has never been a revolution in any advanced country. Industrial society has not eliminated poverty, but it has eliminated the hungry mob as a force of history.
Yeah, this is where I was going to start with the hungry mob. And the hungry mob, as he describes it here in this essay, is one part proletariat, but also really largely a peasant mob.
Yeah, I was actually reading Endnotes Volume 4, and they go through the history of modern revolutions going all the way back to 1848. And they point out, at no point except in the Spanish Civil War, maybe, mm-hmm. And in the German case where they lost, so you're looking at two revolutions that lost. Did you not have basically a peasants mob pretty much leading the revolution? And they also, Endnotes also picks the opposite of Jacobin. Mm-hmm. Endnotes also picks up on the fact that it actually took World War II to fully depossess and assimilate the Ancien Régime into the bourgeois order. So either by kicking it out or just making the bourgeois. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Jacobin uses this information to come to the opposite conclusion of Lash and of like people like Robert Brenner, that the bourgeois revolutions were largely bourgeois affairs, where Endnotes says, no, the bourgeois revolutions were largely peasant affairs. That you know, the bourgeois were able to use to consolidate against the Ancien Régime. Now, I will also say they make that claim in an essay that is only like 20 pages long and very hard to prove. So I'm not
well,
saying
Lach
that
says something indoors. Similar when he says that the revolutionary class in any particular struggle isn't the class that's going to be taking power, but the class that's fading away.
Right.
The hungry mob is a peasant class, but the bourgeois class takes power. So, I just yesterday I recorded a podcast with a Patreon supporter and with Danny. So Misha and Danny, we all three read the third chapter in Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. And as I was reading it, Trotsky explained his theory of uneven development and how it applied to the Russian Revolution, I was struck by how bourgeois the conditions were, or to put it differently, that the conditions weren't bourgeois, but the struggle was bourgeois in the sense that it was about modernizing the country, industrializing the country, supplanting or replacing the old aristocracy with the new bourgeois class, and that all the contradictions that arose in that society that Trotsky described were coming about because of that process that was already underway, and which they would still be stuck with after the revolution. That right. It was hardly complete.
So it's interesting because that actually contradicts some of Marx's predictions in his late letters about the Mir. As having an alternate mode of development. Although I don't say that as a condemnation of Marx. I think part of what's going on there is Marx is just trying to play out what it would look like for the Mir to be the modernization separate from a capitalist order. And that doesn't happen. I mean, what you start seeing in Tsarist Russia is the like absolutism to compete with the more developed capitalist powers has to take on capitalist production methods. And, you know, but does it, I mean, just very shittily.
Well, when we did the podcast on 1848, one of the conclusions that we came to there was that the early socialist struggles were not as aware of the difference between the Republican bourgeois members of their struggle, you know, that aspects of the struggle and their own socialist ambitions, that they were different, but they were not seen as being as much as opposition as they would be later on. In fact, the development of Marxism is sort of the development of that realization.
Right. Well, I can read a relevant thing because Lash actually does go back into the deeper history here a bit. I mean, he Robert Brenner isn't writing yet, but he seems to be almost preempting a debate that people had against Brenner. Even in Europe, where the parliamentary forms have made some headway during the late Middle Ages, the early modern state are exemplified by the Stuart regime in England and the Bourbon regime in France, ruled not so much through civil institutions, church, schools, courts, parliaments, as through direct imposition of bureaucratic authority and military force. The same is true to an even greater degree of the right-wing dictatorships of modern China, Vietnam, and Cuba before the revolutions. Mm-hmm. An important result of this underdevelopment of civil society and the authoritarian state control is that its opposition to the state and to the existing order, i.e. opposition of any kind, has to take a revolutionary form. Absolutism almost inevitably nourishes a revolutionary negation of itself and forces the state to rely more and more on naked force, thus undermining its own pretensions to divine right or, in the end, any other form of legitimacy.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I've written down here, too. That, like, I summarized it as revolution is more likely in countries where the government takes the form of a dictatorship or an authoritarian or autocratic rule. And in societies where civil society is underdeveloped, that's right. Where revolution is more likely to occur. And that's because there's no other way to express opposition except through radical revolutionary opposition.
Right.
According to Lash.
And Lash going through here is also going through the fact that he thinks that in response to these problems after, you know, the workers' revolutions that were attempted were more or less put down or incorporated into a bourgeois state in the case of the Mexican Revolution, that the socialists kept on expanding the definition of revolution in a more and more metaphorical way.
I want to address Trev Ken here, who says, haha, these guys are lost in a conceptual pseudo-intellectualism. And I just want to point out that we're not talking about big concepts at all here. We're talking about the history of revolution, concrete history, based on what motivates real people, right?
Yeah, that's a coward's out. I don't mind alienating our audience. If you want to call the dealing with the typographies of the classes pseudo-intellectualism, I'm betting you just don't want to deal with the fact that you're ruled by somebody.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice way of putting it. No, I would just say, like, if you want pseudo-intellectualism, you know, we could start talking about Deleuze or something, but we're actually talking about the history of socialism here. And Susan Murray asks, who bought Douglas a comb? I didn't use a comb. I just had a haircut, but look, see, little bits of it are still sticking up on top. All right. So maybe I was reacting to that comment may not even have been directed at us. Maybe these guys or somebody else that they're discussing. So I'm just going to move on. But yeah, here we are getting a little aggressive in the, at the commenters so early on in the game. I'm going to turn the comments off. I'll look at them for a while. All right. So back to the points that Lash was raising. The main thing that he brings up in various ways is that our conception of revolution, it comes from the 19th century,
right,
and earlier, from the French and maybe even the American Revolution, but he doesn't mention the American Revolution. And also that it, by the end of the 19th century, in the early 20th century, that conception was fading away. He talks about the crisis in Marxism, and the way in which most Marxists believed, who are part of the social democratic movement, that what needed to be done was intervention through the state electorally, using the parliamentary system to gain the state control, and through trade unions to change the,
right,
the nature of production, without necessarily a violent revolution.
And we talk about like what Hilferding and even late Ingalls, although to be fair, Winkowski edited Ingalls' notes on revolution or parliament, where Ingalls says, you know, we could take power through parliamentary force if we had full enfranchisement. Yeah, Ingalls also says that there still probably will not to be not just a defensive insurrection, but probably an actual insurrection against, you know, established powers. And when Kowski published that, he took those out, mm-hmm, to make Ingalls seem more congenial to the Kowski position. But we get from Bernstein into late Kowski and into Hilferding this idea that you could do it through trade unions, and later on we could just do it through the development of capitalism itself, through the
Bernsteinian kind of deviation, right, that needs to be smashed.
Well, but, I mean, but it's also like, I mean, Hilferding is the Hilferding and Lenin took, like, Lenin took Hilferding's data and Hilferding took Hilferding's data, and they came to opposite conclusions about what it means. Almost Lenin thought it was gonna mean that there would be a chance for revolution through not the immiseration of capital, but through the division of war, particularly after, you know, the defection of the Zimmerwald left. And then Hilferding took it as, well, the monopoly capital just means we need to parliamentarily seize the monopolies once they fully develop. And we might even need to suppress labor unions to some degree, to develop that monopoly so that we can then consolidate through parliamentarily process through the workers' vote. Mm-hmm. Now, I hate to say it now, Lenin looked more right at the time, but it's hard to say.
I don't think either of them are particularly right necessarily, but
But at the time, Lenin looked more right, but Lenin also still believed that they would have to hook up to a revolutionary movement from the proletariat in Germany and in England and in the rest of the developed capitalist world, mm-hmm, which never happened. And so you get into a pretty huge bind. Where did they go? Like, how can you possibly lead? And I think this, you know, one of the things that we forget, because we're now in this moment where we're all talking about the working class again, although we're always vague and hesitant to define what it means. Many common words that people think actually express things often don't. It's actually a problem I sometimes have with Lash himself. He'll talk about working class in ways that are cultural, are before you actually had a wage earning proletariat or whatever. Mm-hmm. And but in this essay, he's pretty on the nose. I'll read some more of it. By the 1900s, however, it was largely abandoned in the hope of overthrowing capitalist society by the means of direct assault on the state. Meanwhile, partial democratization of political life opened up the possibility of achieving socialism through trade unionism and parliamentary politics. This did not mean that the socialists have become to agree on every detail of strategy and tactics, or even on fundamental issues. Revisionists like Bernstein argue that the capitalists have been overcome by its contradictions, and therefore, in effect, socialist objectives could be achieved within capitalism.
Slow down. I'm not following you.
Revisionists like Bernstein argued that capitalism had overcome its contradictions, and that therefore, in effect, socialist objectives could be achieved within capitalism itself. So the contradictions which cause the business cycle is what he's talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That you could always find one of the countervailing factors or externalities or whatever to prevent the business cycle.
Was he talking about those, or was he talking about the contradictions that led to a more generalized crisis, or are they not different?
At this time, they're not different. I mean, you got to remember that at this early stage, most Marxists thought that the crisis of depressions would automatically lead to immiseration and then into revolution. I mean, most of them thought that the long depression, or sometimes also called the first Great Depression, in Europe and in the United States, and even in the
19th century.
In the 19th century, mm-hmm. would actually be the prompting towards.
Right. I mean, the first crisis in Marxism came out of this moment where that didn't happen and there was a boom.
Right. But let me get to the next part. Orthodox mm-hmm. Marxists like Eugene Debs, on the other hand, took the position that the capitalist institutions would have to be destroyed before socialism could become reality. But not even the latter any longer advocated the destruction of state power through a frontal assault or questioned the importance of electoral strategy. They ridiculed the view, in fact, still popular amongst anarchists and other ultra-leftists, that capitalism would end in a sudden crash. And indeed, they went so far as to argue that this cataclysmic conception of the breakdown of capitalism, as Louis Baudin, I think, put it in 1907 in a book largely devoted to the attack on revisionism, is not a part of Marxian theory.
You know, I just thought of something that we might talk about in the Parrot Room, but I'll mention briefly now, which is that around the time, let's say March, April of this year, when COVID first started to hit and the impact on the economy was really becoming obvious. It wasn't felt yet, but it was there in the stats, right? I thought that we could be, I mean, I started rereading Heinrich Grossman and reconsidering my earlier position on the nature of crisis and capitalism. And I still am not sure about it. But, I thought, hey, it's quite conceivable in this moment that the crisis in capitalism will be such that it can't be resolved, that even through devaluation and a new boom, that you won't be able to get profitability back up to the level where you can sustain a workforce and a capitalist class, which is what Grossman talks about as right. a terminal crisis. And I think that may have been in the background as a second Black Lives Matter movement started. Mm-hmm. In some people's minds, I'm not, we can talk about whose minds, but in the Parrot Room. But the enthusiasm that people had for the rioting in late May, early June may have been connected to this subconscious, partially maybe, idea that there was going to be a terminal crisis, that it was going to happen suddenly, that this was it. I just bring that up as to say that these problems and questions and the way that ultra-leftists like myself sometimes think comes back again and again.
But the problem with the way of thinking is you almost can always find, even from Grossman's model, that you're undervaluing one of the countervailing tendencies, use Grossman's terminology, against right. the final crisis. And, but I want to get to this next part because this is important.
Okay.
World War I and the Russian Revolution profoundly altered the history of the socialist movement. The major social democratic party's capitulation to the war discredited social democracy, while at the same time, the Russian Revolution gave the insurrectionary tradition a new lease on life. The more recent revolutions in China, Vietnam, Cuba, and Algeria have developed ideologies and institutions appropriate to the problems of predominantly agrarian societies. And by the way, have also, since this essay was written, this essay is written in the mid to late 60s, have all developed institutions parallel to, if not actually, capitalist institutions. While the social democratic movements have continued to degenerate until the recent years, they have become outright accomplices of the imperialism disguised as the worldwide crusade against the communist totalitarianism, in quotations. The early 20th century had seen a promising steps towards a theoretical synthesis of the insurrectionary and social democratic traditions, particularly in Antonio Gramsci. These efforts, however, have come to nothing. As a result, the socialist movement finds itself lacking either a theory or a practice appropriate to the realities of advanced industrial society. The most militant elements cling to an antiquated theory of revolution, while the rest have embraced the Democratic Party. The Labor Party are some of their continental equivalents.
Yeah. Well, that still seems to be the case today, huh?
Well, I mean, what is interesting is he then goes through this New Left detour that we have now circled back on. And the New Left detour was the hope that either the most immiserated parts of the Black community, and Lash has a lot of good things to say about Black nationalism. In fact, it informs his theory of the working class. But that was somehow going to lead the revolution, or students and other declasse elements were going to lead the revolution. This was a common view in the 60s. I mean, and it seemed to have been supported by Nanterre because of 68. But we also know where that all goes. And like,
but that Nanterre was not, strictly speaking, not a working class movement, because that was a working class university, kind of uniquely so, in France.
I said seems, though.
Yeah, right, I mean, right.
I mean, you know.
And also, it didn't work out either, did it? But yeah, we agree. The one thing I want to point out that before we get into the New Left, and I think at this moment we should consider to the degree to which the New Left, as it was, has been thoroughly absorbed and transformed into the Democratic Party. I don't think New Left ideas can be really separated out from the Democratic Party now. But I want to point out that what he was saying about what he says about violent revolution in this essay, he echoes an agony of the left when he describes the decline of the Socialist Party of America,
right,
and how and the effect that the Soviet Revolution had on them. And it seems like he's kind of mentioning it here as something that sort of had a lasting effect, where the idea of the ultra leftists came back after the Soviet revolution, after the Russian Revolution.
I once was going to write myself a history of the cycles of ultra left popularity, which they seem to come up about every generation and a half. And we saw some again, like after Occupy. But when we say popularity, we mean relative to a very obscure section of society. It never reaches anything like.
In the 90s, the anarchists were fairly popular in the Pacific Northwest.
By that time, radical politics is a milieu. Like it is a social identity as much as anything else. Like it is something you can take on during college and drop afterwards, which again is a side effect of some of the theories of the left focusing on students. And there's structural, functional reasons to focus on students.
Why was I not smart enough to drop it afterwards? Oh, because I kept dropping out of college. That's why. I kept dropping out of college and going back, so it didn't end soon enough for me. All right.
I think we want to go into this, though, because I think we're seeing this as far now. Like, I just want to, like, go into one more section of this. Another approach after the 1950s, I'm just going to add that bracket that in, because approach seeks to rescue the idea of revolution from irrelevance by disassociating it from the traditional view that socialism can only emerge from the struggles of the proletariat, and by pointing instead to new classes or groups that allegedly developed revolutionary potential. Skip, skip, skip. They contend, in particular, those who seek substitutes for the proletariat argue that while the working class has ceased to play a revolutionary role, or in some cases, they argue that they never did, the new social groups ready to leap into the breach are particularly Blacks and students. They contend that the Blacks demand revolution. But in fact, the Black community is far from unified in demanding any such thing. Even Blacks who regard themselves as revolutionaries do not agree among themselves, let alone with right radicals, about what they would mean by revolution. In addition to Blacks, students and professionals are often described as a revolutionary force. In the case of students, this conclusion rests more on wishful thinking than any careful analysis. A large minority of students, and possibly even a majority on a few campuses, may well sympathize with radical attacks on university or with the aspects of those attacks, but these attacks themselves ever seldom become revolutionary whatever the accompanying rhetoric. And I find it funny because we forget that a lot of the early revolutionary movements were attacking university, because after this period, these students go, a lot of them go into the university itself and become faculty. And you have, you know, what would later be called, you know, what I have jokingly called, I think cribbing from someone else, the long march through academia, where...
I'm sorry I got distracted from what you're talking about, but listen, I want to say everything you just said sounded right to me. And, you know, of course, I when I read that section in The Lash myself, it was like, it was so relevant that it almost seemed cliche, right? Mm-hmm. The dismissal of the students at a revolutionary moment. But this guy, John Connors, chapped my ass. Strange how far left influencers don't mention that FDR was pressured into the New Deal. FDR was pressured into the New Deal. I'm mentioning it now. And now they're doing shows about how revolution isn't possible during an attempted fascist coup. There is no attempted fascist coup going on. Trump is making a stink, and he's going to end up as a media personality. Giuliani's a joke. There's no fascist coup. We're not trying to say revolution is impossible because we don't want revolution. We're trying to say, hey, there's a lot of impediments to revolution. This has been a problem for a long time. Why don't we think through what they were so we can overcome them? All right.
So what are you going to do about said fascist coup? Vote? Fuck off.
We've already voted. And look, it's clear to me that, I mean, I would be willing to bet quite a bit of money this is not going to go anywhere except into a long-term cultural myth that maybe half of the right embraces about the outcome of this election.
I want to ask you, like, in all seriousness, part of the problem that Lash is asking you, all right? Mm-hmm. I've heard all this talk of civil war for the past year and a half from anarchists and adjacent liberals. What class basis do you have for that civil war, and what weapons? Yes, you can go buy firearms and go fight with paramilitary people in the hills outside of Portland. But if you actually came up against the U.S. military, it would take about 3 drones to wipe you out. Now,
there's no chance. The thing about that is Trump doesn't have control over the military. Most of the people in the military would very much like to see him gone.
But people are talking about this attempt at fascist coup through legal fiat, which is interesting and not an actual military grade coup.
Which has just happened in Peru, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so they got rid of their president there through charges of corruption and basically impeachment. But
that's what they did with Dilma Rousseff too.
Right.
And I mean, I will not be surprised if you start seeing this in the United States. But I'm going to tell you that if you study the history left-wing reactions to coup in Latin America, where the military and government is a lot weaker than it is here, I can't think of that many examples where it ends well through the insurrection. It usually ends through the insurrection leading to a weakened blockade and bourgeois forces calling for an election, you know, usually after the military steps down to avoid a conflict. I mean, if you look at what happened in the Egyptian Revolution, which, by the way, I lived through the counter revolution of, I was there. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened there. And what we saw was the power vacuum was created. Another counterforce stepped in. The revolution could not face even a weakened Egyptian state. They did not fight the government in an insurrectionary manner. They fought basically by a mixture of general strike and breaking down the economic system, which they effectively did, which had the military depose Mubarak and allow elections. Then they let the Muslim Brotherhood get involved in its own political cul-de-sacs, since the Muslim Brotherhood did not replace most of the military state apparatus and functionaries, because they had nobody to do those functions, and they just assumed power again and called an election. And then when the terrorist attack happened in response to that election, they reinstated the emergency rules that Mubarak had lived under, but now under al-Sisi. Like, if you think that is a model for revolution, you got nothing historically to back you up.
Nothing. Yeah, I mean, look, it's pretty clear that those kinds of comments are coming from people who are very committed to the Democratic Party, and I'll just leave it at that. And that want to stop conversations that go beyond the bounds of choosing sides and between Republicans and Democrats. That's my conclusion on that. So going back to Lash, I wanted to bring up something about, I wanted to bring up something that was, echoed in, Agony, which I think I already had, but that was, I brought up how his assessment of how the Soviet Union affected the American socialist tradition was here in this essay as well. But then there's also this sort of commitment to I'm going to call it a communitarian culture,
right?
A rural communitarian culture that is in this essay. But he calls it humanism here. And he says that the motivating force behind the ideological motivating force behind revolution tended to be either the commitments to traditional communitarian religious values or a new kind of civic minded humanism, which was what the bourgeois revolutions promised to deliver, and that a left without that second commitment to a kind of humanism has nothing to offer ideologically or maybe in terms of identity to would-be revolutionaries.
Right. I mean,
I see that in the culture of narcissism and in the agony of the left, but especially in the culture of narcissism, it's that same preoccupation.
So I think maybe I can tie that into the end of this sentence and then we can maybe respond to some of these kinds of comments in a serious way instead of me just yelling at the audience.
I think I was acting like I was channeling you, and you're right there. I was yelling at people.
Yeah. I mean, I want to read the end of the essay because people think we're arguing against revolution and we are not. Neither was Lash. Revolution today may represent, among other things, the only hope of preserving what is worth preserving from the past, including man's natural habitat itself. But if that is the case, it is time that the 19th century idea of revolution be drastically revised or abandoned altogether.
Mm-hmm. And so it may be that those 19th century ideas need to be revised more than they need to be abandoned, or that our conceptions of them, rereading the 19th century is probably a very worthwhile thing to do, I would suspect, if you want to understand just what the limits of revolutionary thought actually were then. And this is all my roundabout way of remaining a true and orthodox and devout Marxist, or you know, fan of Marx, because I think a lot of things kind of developed into dogma around what it takes to have a revolution that may not have been nearly as dogmatic even in the 19th century. But I'll let you talk now.
Well, I mean, we have been stuck in cul-de-sacs of like what it meant to marry these revolutions that happened before the full development of the capitalist state. I don't like using the industrial society state because we're not even in that industrial society anymore. What Lash is really referring to are both methods of control developed, ironically, he thinks partly by progressives to make a more, to get rid of the old entrepreneurial capitalists and make for a more efficient form of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But also the weapons of war that the Cold War and World War II created, making a state that could wield power in ways that they couldn't fathom. And by the way, like that trend, even though we don't see it as directly because it's world, I mean, I'm going to sound a little bit like a third worldist Maoist for a second, but something you really need to think about. Like, wait till you see drones deployed in the Western world and Western people. It will eventually happen. Or you're going to start seeing drone conventions like we treated nuclear bombs. Like, those are your two options. All right? Because those weapons, you know, those weapons still exist. When we're talking right now against you play acting, you know, warfare against militias out in Idaho. And yeah, that's a very, I actually even think that's a real interpersonal threat for a lot of people. I'm not even demeaning that, but that is not a war. And that is not an insurrection against the center of capital.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things about this essay by Lash is that he's good at, in a very clear and straightforward way, kind of delineating the differences between like a coup and a rebellion and a revolution.
Right.
And we have been through, I think recently we've been through an actual rebellion.
Yeah. We've been through a rebellion.
Like within this year. I mean, I think there was a rebellion after the murder of George Floyd.
Right. And I mean, look guys, I actually do think because of the civic institutional way we could see coups in the intermediate future, all right? I don't even discount that, but this idea.
But who would do it? Who do you think would do the coups?
I don't know. I mean, but this
one of the problems for us sitting in America will be to figure out when a coup has happened. I think in Peru, it was easier for people there. But I mean, I saw leftists on Facebook, I won't say who, talk about this election as a coup against Trump. And they weren't our usual suspects either, although the information was coming through that channel. But some other, you know, there are people who would take it seriously that there was a coup against Trump. I think that's ridiculous. I think it's equally ridiculous to think that Trump is attempting what I would call a coup right now as well. He's being completely, he's norm busting like I've never seen before. But I don't think any chance of him changing the outcome of the election. And if he did, I would actually trust the courts. I know that sounds crazy, but it's what, I mean, so far the courts have been, well, they would, I, you know, they're turning away all of his, filings because of the lack of evidence.
Oh no, that's not why I say it sounds crazy. The reason why
to flip the votes in Michigan and Wisconsin and Georgia, I would expect that there would be the evidence would be transparent and that there would be real evidence. Otherwise, I wouldn't expect that to happen.
Right. I don't think there's any way they can flip enough state. Like if it was just one state, then yes, I
agree.
I can see it. But one of the things I'll say in response to this, when you say who can perform a coup, and maybe you're right when you say that, like, we won't even know anymore, is the paranoia about coups, when you talk about things like social stasis, can actually breed a ground where coups are more possible because every side thinks the other side is going to do it and the incentive not to starts to decline over time. Here's the thing though. I don't think the ruling class of the United States and its bourgeois funders are actually at that point yet. I do not believe it, but I do not put it behind. I do not put it beside anybody for it to happen. Nor do I not see how this busting of norms and tying things up in the legal gambit that is happening is dangerous. But what I am going to say is I also think it is not just kind of absurd, but like the belief that you can call coup underway before you've even had the beginnings of a court reversal just through the act of throwing up a bunch of frivolous lawsuits and challenges and having the GOP Senate talk out of both ends of its mouth, like that functions in a way to degrade norms. But another thing I want to get back to, though, is if we're talking about right now, scratch a Marxist and you might find a Democrat or a Republican. Really?
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things I've learned in this election is, like, scratch a Marxist, scratch an anarchist. They're not, like, we're against the government, but we want the establishment of status quo norms. Like,
come on.
Like, do you know how absurd that looks? Conversely, to the other side, I mean, we're militias, you know, militia patriots against totalitarianism, and we're literally talking for an anti-democratic legal fiat ruling so that we can keep power because
did you see my interview with Steve Janecki?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of that, he's like, you know, people are saying, QAnon saying that Trump was the alternative to having a military coup and that the coup would have been justified given how corrupt Washington is. Why are they so corrupt? Because they're getting in the way of the free market. I mean, this is the craziness, right? They weren't neoliberal enough. You know, it's no one's ideologically consistent. So I do think that you're right. You scratch a Marxist, you could find a Republican. Or you can find a Democrat. I guess you could also find a Green Party.
Yeah, you're more likely to find a Democrat, but yeah, much but more, yes. Yeah. But I mean, look, I'm not even telling people that, oh, we should have like struck out for our own Marxist party and because we are nowhere near there yet.
Hey, let's save some of this energy for the parrot room for the people who pay for this crap. Let's take a few questions. But we didn't even talk about Harold Cruz and that much.
Maybe we'll come back to this idea of Lash and the and like his concerns about the rural culture, because right now if we look at voting trends, as much as class, region is playing a huge role, even in some ways more weirdly than race, and the regions are shifting about who's aligned with whom. If you look at the states as a whole, I mean, you look at Georgia, for example, but like if you look at Georgia in detail, and the New York Times did this recently, the urban vote isn't what changed. In fact, it went just a little bit down, which is weird, given how high the voting proportions were. And by urban here, largely it's a code for them for black in Atlanta. It was the suburban vote that changed.
Yeah, but that was predictable before the election.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I mean,
but look, this is the kind of contemporary bullshit we keep for the parrot room.
All right, we'll go to the parrot room. Let's answer questions.
Yeah, and let's ask her a few questions here. Let's see. Is reading or watching Mark Fisher good for my mental health? Major depression?
Probably not.
No. I mean, he's a good read, but I would not say that he'll make you feel any better. I would say, like, watch some crappy TV and have a beer.
I would tell you that if you have serious depression, seek
help. Really, right. That's true. But if you in the interim. If you're looking to entertainment as on your way to the, psychiatrist for the prescription, you know, don't read any Marxist. Do something, you know, frivolous. Wouldn't you agree the chances of revolution radically go up if we have large scale draft for an unpopular war?
Yeah. Okay, so you do have you do have chances of a overthrow of government, which is a kind of revolution.
Is However, it or is it a coup?
But it could just be a coup if you don't really change the means of production, which that doesn't really affect.
You know, I want to jump in. Lash, when he talks about what a revolution is, he doesn't talk about it in terms of material production. He talks about it in changes in the form of government.
Because he's arguing that basically the notion that we're inheriting from the 19th century is the notion that it is a change in the world and the term of government. Now, I'm not saying that he thinks that it should have been an economic revolution. You know, our general strike.
To be. It can't just be an economic revolution.
Right.
Well, if you really have an economic revolution, that would necessitate a change in the state.
But it does seem like one of the implications of the end of his question is like, well, if we're going to save the notion of revolution, all right, from both it being made meaningless by metaphor by liberals and even conservatives, or from constantly trying to replay things that happened in the periphery of capital 100 years ago, that when we try it in any city, we get crushed doing and a bunch of people die. You know, and we never really get to, I mean, like, honestly, since the 50s, we haven't even gotten to the point where people have really tried it that much. In a core of capital, I mean, I guess you can argue that they sort of attempted it in the quote unquote golden age of terrorism in the 60s. But, you know, it seemed to have been, as Lash was pointing out, something that came out of agricultural societies with imperialist interests, et cetera, and so forth.
So there's a question here. Let's see. So Sarah Books acknowledged we all witnessed, lived through rebellions this past year. The burnings of police precinct in Minnesota was an inspired act of justice. It changed things. Too few recognize this.
Yeah. I don't think that's debatable. Like, it was more than a riot.
Yeah, it was. And to the degree to which it changed things, I think that's a little bit debatable. But
Well, it changed things, but we don't know what it means.
We don't know what has changed yet.
Right. Yeah. Like, it's too, what is that apocryphal thing that Joanne Lai about the French Revolution, which was actually about the French student left. And Joanne Lai just goes, you know, it's too early to tell.
This guy's asking what we think of Veblen. And I agree with Adorno about Veblen, but then again, I've only read Veblen in bits, like excerpts from Veblen, and I've read more recently an essay about Veblen by Adorno. But Veblen was for Adorno a fellow traveler. You could tell Adorno respected Veblen's critique, but he ultimately came down on Veblen as a positivist, meaning Veblen accepted industrial production and the capitalist system and was actually working to try to accommodate society to the new industrial rational society that he embraced. And so his critique of consumerism is a critique of the inefficiency and the backward superstitious nature of conspicuous consumption rather than a critique of conspicuous consumption as a block to a revolutionary movement to change the mode of production.
Right.
That would be my response to Veblen.
My response is similar. The Veblen's critique of capricious consumption is interesting, and you do have to factor it out for intra-class competition as well as inter-class competition. And people like Eric Olin Wright have, however, sloppily tried to do that. However, I do think basically the critique that Veblen was promoting a more efficient system that was totally in line with what, you know, the new larger scale rentier capitalists really want, particularly as industrial production sort of started to die down, that we needed to make society more efficient beyond that was completely correct. And I also, you know, one of the interesting things about this essay implied by it is that a lot of times leftists are actually doing the capitalist work for them in changing the way we organize around a new organizational trend in capitalism.
Gene Reese Bodlon says that we are downers.
We are downers.
That's our job, man. What do you want? We're not what, you know.
I mean, the task here, though, isn't to take all the wind out of your sails. The task here is to ask you, like, what are we going to do about it? Like, I'm not going through this to be like, oh, we know all the categories of revolution, like the person implied at the beginning, are to go, oh, revolution's impossible, because I wouldn't be a Marxist if I didn't think you could have world historical changes.
Yeah, I think we can too, but I feel like we have to go through a dark night of the soul before we can get there. And it hasn't been dark enough, regardless of what went down on the mothership. Thank you, Anxiety of the Spectacle, for your super chat. This has been reading leftist thinkers for 20 plus years and falling for the scream of revolution like a boy crazy teen. But how do we overcome the glaring problem of the vampire castle and divisivism? The division in the left. I think that the Vampire Castle essay by Mark Fisher is worthwhile. It's worth reading. After a certain point, though, my feeling about it is, look, the working class isn't part of the Vampire Castle. Vampire Castle is mostly a problem for people who are trying to develop media careers or be an actual, like, electoral politics, maybe. So recognize that a lot of the thinking that goes on, let's say, amongst the educated elites that are part of the liberal establishment have no relevance to most working people, and leave it at that. Try to be a decent person instead.
As a side note to that, I'm actually going to add a little hymn of disunity. Some disunity amongst the working class is organic and natural and has to be overcome through. I mean, it's
like, give me an example. Give us an example, Derek. What are you thinking of? Well, you think about the rural urban divide again or something?
I'm thinking about the rural urban divide. I'm thinking about, like, for example, when like labor was able to use segregated unemployed black workers to break on Manx, specifically miners, and then force them into whiteness. Like, those are sectional interests that yes, can be overcome by working class interests, but in the immediate term, they are real divisions that are not even totally motivated by bigotry. You have to, I know you hate this word, Doug, but you do have to have an intersectional analysis of how to overcome those things. Even if intersectionalism, as the way it's used in popular popular politics, can be just a distraction, like, you do have to deal with the fact. Like, I mean, this is not just true between, like, white and like, you know, white workers and people of color. It's true between different groups of people than color themselves, and will be more true as the population in the United States is less and less white.
When you say intersectional, though, don't you really mean to say a materialist conception? Because what you're talking about are the different interests in real time, historically, the different material interests in terms of the relationship to the mode of production, their identity or these fixed categories of intersectionality, which are worthwhile in a legal context, in the context of protecting rights, which, if you want to work on that level, you should do. But don't, isn't that what you mean?
I would encourage people, if you can find it, to read, I don't normally plug myself, to read my response to Mark Fisher about making intersectional analysis materialist and not about total abstract identity. However, I'm going to pause it there because this will pivot us to another conversion. I also think that a lot of people, in response to quote unquote identity politics, instead of trying to figure out ways to include and undo the problems that lead to it, they just posit a fucking worker's identity that is basically based on an industrial blue collar worker that, frankly, today is more likely to be petite bourgeois, and B, even more so, probably doesn't exist in the developed world in the way we like to pretend.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Let's go on to this next person who paid to ask a question, which, by the way, I want to encourage everyone to throw up the super chat if they can afford it. Given their relative historical success in their Is there anything to learn from the Italian Communist Party's experience 1945 to 1990? I can't answer this. You go ahead, Derek.
I would say that the Italian Communist Party got stuck in a cul-de-sac, though. I mean, like, yes, it was relatively successful. It was enough to scare the bourgeois parties into constant coalitions against them. I mean, like, even capitalists will admit that it led to political instability in Italy, because the Communist Party was always there and around and forcing people to go, let's battle them. But after the 90s, they really lost steam and turned into a bunch of different movements, because they never could get out of their electoral framework again because of Italy's kind of weird remoteness. I mean, like, just physically from the USSR, an inability to truly hook up on, like, the Warsaw Pact. And I'm not even sure that would have made them communists or anything. I'm just, like, doing geostrategy here. But also, so they couldn't really hook up with anybody because they had to get through all the rest of Western Europe, and that they still had to, and they were still, they didn't have a large enough, like, militant movement to really force the bourgeois coalitions to truly take them completely seriously. So yes, you can learn a lot about electoral strategy from them, but you also can learn a lot about the limits of electoral strategy from them.
Anxiety of the Spectacle shows a clown face. I want to give everyone a chance to one more round of questions here. Someone says, I've never seen intersectionality do anything but erode solidarity. I would say that probably that's because you've mostly encountered intersectionality on college campuses or in activist groups.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I honestly wish we talked about, because when I talk about intersectionality, I don't mean anything other than like a lens of looking at material conditions for specific groups, in which Doug is right about that, and trying to understand maybe what kind of subjective experience that would prompt in people. What I do not mean is like trying to like have some kind of radical division amongst groups or whatever.
How do we overcome the iron law of institutions? Patrick Toole asks, and he paid for it. And then he,
good old Robert Michel. The iron law of institutions, or the iron law of oligarchy, which is that any institution that thinks has a drift towards a bureaucratic elite, which eventually separates itself from the workers over time. You see this shows up on both right-wing critiques of Marxism. James Burnham brings it up, as did the fascist. And the fascist had a very much, if you can't beat them, just do it attitude about it. And so did James Burnham, by the way, after he left the trots. However, it also comes up in people like In Notes, pointing out that like this has happened in labor unions and other established bureaucracies, particularly they were legal and paying. I hate to sound like a trot or a Maoist, but you have to tear those institutions down periodically.
What about just the idea that if you don't have a working class, the elite can't separate itself from it? I mean,
you have to, like, the question is not the iron law of institutions in a classless society. The question is, how do you overcome the iron law of institutions when you're trying
to build? I would say in a revolutionary moment where the dictatorship of the proletariat, say, is overseeing the transformation of the mode of production so that we can have socialism, which might run on something like labor notes. It might be something different, but we'd have socialism, which is a break from capitalist production and commodity production. That's broken after revolution, you know, in a few months to a year, say. If you posit that,
wildly optimistic. All right, go ahead.
Look, we've got supercomputers now. So in any case, so if you posit all that, then the iron law of institutions doesn't exist anymore, but there probably is still an iron law of elite hierarchy.
Well, I mean, which
go ahead. Yeah.
The robot Michelle's is called the Iron Law of Institution, but it actually, even more so, to be completely honest, is a way of like is something like an elite hierarchy rule, because it doesn't just apply to like formal bourgeois institutions. It applies to anything that has a leadership core that can start allocating resources towards itself.
Right.
So
well, that's what that would be broken. The material resources allocating towards itself would be at least partially broken. I think
by what?
Capitalist society.
Well, yeah, but
by again, the fact that you're
it pro is not a capitalist society.
But like in my imaginings, that there would be competition amongst elites, and there probably would be some material effects from that. But it would be based on what kinds of production is going to be.
So you imagine
dominating.
A capitalist society with elites?
Yes. With elites that are, for instance, people whose ideas around production are more popular than others. People
so
who have more sway.
I'm going to point out, maybe this will go up in a parrot room, but I just feel like I caught you at the same time when you got Ben Burgess on talking about a classist society with the progressive income tax.
Well, no, I don't think I did, but I do think that it's worth examining because I could have. But what I mean by that is, look, they're not going to be elites in so much as that they control the resources in terms of who consumes them, but rather that they're more popular in terms of determining what kinds of forms of production people are going to be participating in. This goes back to, you know,
this is your gamification theory of communism.
Yeah. Or my turning production into the purpose of life as a game or as an artistic endeavor.
We would like to call it Marxist-Leninist doctor of thought.
That's right. Yeah. And look, I admit that once you start saying, look, there are going to be a group of people of different types that are going to have more sway, you know, let's call them influencers, that over what kinds of forms of production are most popular and therefore what people want to participate in, there's a chance for conflict that could be violent even. I mean, I can imagine like someone having to investigate a murder as jealousy arises between influencers or, you know, someone who's, you know, like it would be, but I imagine that to be different than the kinds of class problems that we perceive today, but I may be wrong on that. I mean, I'll have to think it through a little bit more. Maybe we can discuss
yeah, we can game that out. Any more questions from the Holy Palooy? The people who are going to overthrow us one day?
One day, like next week, any one of these people could have a more popular YouTube channel than us. Look, every single one of these people that's talking to us has a YouTube channel.
Isn't intersectionality just another term for imperialism? Oh my God.
I don't think so.
I think if you mean intersectionality as it is used by liberals, liberalism could be another. I don't even think that's another term for imperialism. It's just something which generates it.
I'm not sure I even understand the question. Okay. I see a cult of personality resulting from Lane's ideas. Look, I've been trying for a long time. It's just not happening. Let's leave it there and we'll move over to the parrot room in like 10, 15 minutes. I do want to say that we should talk about Lash as a personality, maybe a little bit in the parrot room, because I find him strangely compelling as a figure. Maybe it's because, you know, for the same reason I like Mr. Rogers or something. He's such a kind of patriarchal Protestant. I'm not sure if he was a Protestant, but he's like such a middle American intellectual of a certain type. I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to land on, but he seems like he is legitimately genteel. Am I wrong there? Is that, you think that might be the way?
I think by the 70s and 80s, probably. I mean, also he does come out of a certain class and doesn't deny that. It's funny.
We'll talk about his personality and
I might make fun of your gamer theory of revolution and the.
But everyone should buy Bash Bash Revolution, which is the manual for the upcoming revolution that I've been leading to this whole time. I end every Pop the Left with that plug now, and we'll go out on this theme.